Belgium Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome to Belgium Talks. I'm Mark Chappell. It's often said that dealing with climate change requires a radical overhaul of the way we live our lives, power our homes, and run our society. Here today to talk us through the transition to a low-carbon economy are sustainability analysts Yasmin Svan and Janku Damrosch. How are you both?
Very well, thank you.
Fine, thanks for having us.
So the question is, the low-carbon economy, are we there yet? Have we reduced the level of emissions enough to counteract the effects of global warming? Janku, where are we?
Well, I think the starting point, you can think of where you have easier options, which you could deploy now, mm-hmm. and the sort of harder to decarbonize sectors. And that's, I think, the key conversation. It's probably the case that the power sector is one which has, so I would say, the low-hanging fruit. If you look at the example of the UK, it's been able to shift quite dramatically within, let's say, 10, 20 years from mm-hmm. being predominantly coal-powered to having quite significant penetration of renewable energy and natural gas. So the power sector is probably the easiest sector to start with.
Yep.
And then you can move on and think about the other sectors which are harder, like transport or heavy transport, shipping, aviation, industry.
But even the low-hanging fruit, as Janku mentioned, while in the U.S. and in Europe we're seeing quite a rapid phase-out of coal-fired energy, in Asia, you have countries like China and India that are driving actually an uptick in global demand for coal. So China appears to be expanding existing coal capacity by a further 25%, according to satellite analysis. And in India, you have coal-fired capacity well beyond the rate of replacement, either underway or planned.
So rate of replacement, what does that entail?
So the average lifespan of a coal plant is about 40 years.
Okay.
So that simply means that India is building more power plants than what is needed to replace the plants that are currently slated for retirement.
So they're really expanding. Where they're choosing to say, we need more power, what kind of power plants we'll choose to buy or build, sorry, is they are making that active decision to say coal is best for us at this point in time. Why is that, Yang? What's driving them to coal rather than, say, other sources?
I mean, India in particular is a specific case because of the access it has to coal and the lack of access it has to other resources. But if you think a bit more broadly, partly I think it's an issue of perception. So things move very quickly in the energy mm-hmm. space. I think a lot of the time, and partly because you're doing decisions which, let's say, have 10, 20 years lifetime or even more, you might assume that the future will look like the past. So partly it's an issue of perception. It's partly an issue of costs. But again, going back to the first point, because things are changing so rapidly, it might be the case that even in jurisdictions where historically coal was the cheapest option you had, things are moving to a point where actually it might be cheaper, to build new renewable energy capacity than to run the things you already have, existing mm-hmm. coal plants. Mm-hmm. So the dynamics are changing quickly, and it's clearly the flip side to that is actually people continue to do this thinking about affordability, but actually it's increasingly the case that in the same countries like China and India, people are also thinking about the health impacts. Mm-hmm. So there are countervailing forces, I think, as well here.
Absolutely. I mean, it was not so long ago. I mean, it was only last year that you really saw the people of Beijing and other major Chinese cities really kind of react heavily against the presence of very dirty coal-fired power generation because of the level of smog, the deaths, the associated deaths. Is health issues really effective here in driving change?
I think so. I think in places like China, where you have coal responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths, I mean, this is clearly unsustainable. You can feel the public pressure. You can see policymakers are getting serious about that. Because the good thing about it is actually coal gives you an easy entry point. It's easy to affect change at scale because coal is concentrated. Ownership is concentrated. So, for example, in Europe, studies have traced around 2/3 of the health damage from coal back to just 10 companies.
Wow.
So if that's the case, say an estimated 7,000 premature deaths in Europe are linked to just these 10 companies, then you have a focal point. You know where you can start to address mm-hmm. the issue. And I think this concern is not a European thing at all, actually. Arguably, it might even be more so in developing economies.
More so in developing countries. I mean, this takes us on to where kind of economies are developing and require... It's not that they... You can't just say, oh, well, everything that's in place has to be replaced with it within that and no new power because we have to remove our transmission, remove our and reduce our emissions. So it's very much about the development of new technology and really things like solar panels, wind turbines. Can we make such a shift from things like coal to oil, natural gas, to renewables on such a grand scale? You mentioned the UK moving such a way, but that was only 40 million people and, you know, it was 50 years ago with a lot more state control. Is this possible worldwide?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, going back to the UK example, you know, there is absolutely historical precedent of governments embarking on these sort of system-wide ranging changes or overhauls. You know, so like in the UK in 1965, the UK found gas in the North Sea. And shortly thereafter, the government began a 10-year national conversion program, which involved the conversion or the physical conversion of all or every gas appliance in the UK, which was 40 million at the time, from highly polluting town gas, which is fuel made from burning coal, to natural gas. So I think that shows that while the challenge in front of us is certainly massive, there's absolutely historical precedent that shows that it can be done.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That 10 years to replace every single power generated heating, the heating appliance in the UK with from one to another is an incredible shift. I guess what I'm trying to get at here is can that happen today on countries of much bigger scale, Yankee?
Well, I think it's an issue that depends on two things. First of all, the economics, and the other thing is the political will. But if you're talking about historical precedent, in cases like China and Indonesia, for example, you have similar examples. Cook stoves would be one example where they shifted, within 10 years, pretty much shifted from one type of cook stove to another, which is more efficient. Mm-hmm. And you have other cases. I mean, air conditioning in the U.S., it took about 10 years for, you know, about 25% of households to have air conditioning. So you can have systemic change within a relatively small, you know, small amount of time. 10 years is not a lot on the planet's cycle.
No, of course not. That's very quick.
Because when people talk about the energy transitions, they usually make this big sort of century-wide shift. You know, the 19th century was about coal or horsepower, and then it took decades and decades. But actually, it's when you start having momentum rather than by the time you finish the change or the switch. Yeah. And I think that's the key element here. And again, once you have the economics, which are changing, and you have the political will on the other side, and we haven't mentioned consumers at all. This is just somehow assumes consumers are just passive. But if you put all of these together, I think you can make an argument that change might be quicker than is currently happening.
Absolutely. And like you mentioned before, that when there are certain tipping points in the system, so when we reach that very crucial tipping point of actually building new renewable capacity will be cheaper than to run existing coal, then I think the pace of change could be very rapid indeed.
And is that to do with the construction materials? I know the price of solar panels, I mean, I've seen this chart on a number of your presentations where solar panels, it's this wonderful, huge drop, like off a cliff edge, if you will, of the price of solar panels being multiple thousands of dollars per gigawatt to being a number of cents.
That's absolutely, and it's interesting to think that that is what people call a learning curve. Mm-hmm. So that number actually reflects how we've become better at doing things, how economies of scale actually work. Mm-hmm. And once you realize that that's not something necessarily static, that's something that's, you know, it's iterative by the very nature. It probably can't go on forever. Yeah. You know, I mean, there are famous predictions in the 1930s about energy becoming too cheap to meter because we have nuclear energy. We haven't really had that, so we still have the meters. But it's still the case that those spectacular drops that you've had in wind technology and solar PV and batteries, you can make the same arguments maybe will be applied to different technologies and the sort of linkages between these technologies and other things like 3D printing or autonomous driving or sensors or, you know, machine learning. I mean, these things can work together and you can have the same types of experience curves, learning curves coming down fast.
Yeah, so it's really a case of adoption. As you mentioned, consumers, we have to think of this in a much more holistic way. It's not just the consumers or passively, like everyone makes a decision to move from one to another. There have to be the right incentives in place. And this is where I assume government subsidies and the role of government spending in R&D must come in, of how can we get to the point where we research and develop the right answers to these problems or the new technologies. Yasmin, what role does the state have in meeting this massive issue?
You know, I think definitely the state has a role to play in some sectors more than others. But for example, I think the construction industry is a really good example where the public sector is actually the construction sector's biggest client. Mm. And key inputs in that sector is cement and steel. And together, these two components make up about 14% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
Wow.
And the public sector or governments, as the construction sector's biggest client, have a key role to play there in building or creating demand for low-carbon cements or using mm-hmm. less emission-intensive construction materials, for example, using wood instead of steel and cement beams.
Yeah.
So that's one example of where there's a key role for the government to play.
They can exert a lot of pressure.
Exactly.
In order to fulfill our contracts, you have to meet certain ecological or emission standards expectations, and that can really drive change, is what
exactly,
you're saying.
Exactly. And it's because no company will invest in the R&D for these products if they don't think that there's going to be a demand.
Mm.
And so that's where I think the role of governments is crucial, because they can demonstrate that there is a demand, and
yeah.
if you develop this project, you'll have a buyer for it.
Exactly. There is a large buyer of these services, and it is worth you as a private company to pursue and meet these expectations.
Exactly.
And I think that's one very key role of the state, and that to many people's minds, that's sort of familiar with the regulatory role of the state. We set these standards. If you meet them, you're good. You're in our mm-hmm. books. Maybe you'll get contracts. But you can think of it, the state, in a slightly different way, as like fostering a kind of ecosystem for innovation. Because
yeah.
it's usually the state as this big lumbering bureaucracy, which is horribly inefficient. It can never innovate. And you have the tinkerers, the entrepreneurs,
yeah.
the guys in their garage who are doing their thing. And if you think about some of the really disruptive things, I mean, top of people's minds when they talk about low carbon is probably things like electric vehicles, Elon Musk, Tesla.
Yeah.
Now, Tesla would not be in the position it's at without significant state support it benefited from.
Mm.
Or other technologies like fracking. No one really foresaw the impact of fracking, let's say, a decade ago. And it's totally changed the market. The U.S. is the world's largest oil producer now.
Mm.
And yet, this technology depended, again, on the state fostering a particular kind of support for technology. So if you can create the right ecosystem where it goes from the basic research, where no one's funding this, up to the level of kind of risk sharing between public and private entities, trade policy, and of course taxation and and subsidies, which are top of people's minds, then you have a right framework which can spur further innovation to the sort of low-carbon technologies. And I think that's a key role here.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's electric vehicles, like the ones created by Tesla, are such a key case study in how can we get more people and more companies to embrace a very traditional company. Now, like, car manufacturers for the last 50 years knew how to make an internal combustion engine, and that's been the way it's been for decades. How can we drive not only a manufacturing shift, but also a consumer mindset shift? And is the right way through subsidies? Is the right way through subsidies for consumers, subsidies for manufacturers? Is this a way to understand the shift at society that we need to adopt more broadly?
I think, yes, certainly there's a role for subsidies as well. But then I also think we have been able to go on as a society, both as consumers and as companies, being able to pass off the cost of sort of negative externalities. So
mm-hmm.
as a consumer, you've been able to eat meat and take intercontinental flights quite cheaply and comfortably for a very long time. And likewise, as an oil company or a mining company or any kind of company, you've been able to go on and pollute and contribute to climate change
yeah.
without any sort of financial impact or you having as a business to account for the environmental impact of your actions. So I think beyond subsidies, I think things like carbon taxes it has a major role to play going forward in helping to steer behavior in the right direction, in a more low carbon direction, if you will.
So no, it's a fascinating behavioral economics problem as a prism to view this problem, would you say, Yankee?
I think so. And I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that the world has embraced electric vehicles before it. The turn of the century in 1900, almost 40% of cars in the U.S. were electric.
40% in 1900?
Yes. But then this guy called Ford came around, so he put out a product and customers embraced it quite rapidly again. So the question is, what exactly spurs this new turnaround when we go back to electrics? Well, how much depends on the right tax structures? That's one thing. But it's definitely the case that once you do have a product, which is lower cost of ownership, if you think of the lifetime of a vehicle, less polluting. You know, you see the stories about around 90% of drivers who have an electric car would never go back to an internal combustion engine. So once you have these sort of behavioral elements falling into place, you do realize that they're probably not going to be turning back.
Exactly. I mean, I guess you don't see that many on the road. And yet, at least in my circle of people I would speak to, maybe thinking about buying their next car or even buying their first car, they're saying, "Well, no, I think I'll wait a little bit longer before I trade in my car, because then the new range of more consumer, cheaper electric vehicles will be available to market." So you're absolutely right that it is coming through of this behavioral changes are falling into place. People are expecting this major shift.
And I think you're touching on this idea of a growth story, because basically if you talk to people and you see that that's on their minds, a lot of people our age maybe don't want to drive a car, but if they do, it's most likely that they're thinking of an electric car. Mm-hmm. So it's thinking about this in terms of not looking at the absolute levels, you know, sales are low, but it's where the growth is likely to come from. And you see this happening already, for instance, in China. About 5% of cars in China are electric, but about 50% of the growth in sales is actually from electric vehicles. So that's obviously where everyone's looking, or should be looking if they aren't, if they're sort of incumbent industry. That's probably where they should be looking. And I think that's why you see most of the car manufacturers just racing to put out models. And it's not just cars, you know, trucks. It's a race. It's literally a race.
Wow.
Which is fitting for a conversation about cars.
Absolutely. I guess the thinking about cars, it seems like perhaps it wouldn't have occurred to people earlier on in the 20th century. But looking at it now, it's a very easy sector to go, here's an output that emits a lot of carbon. How can we decarbonize? We move to a more renewable source of power. What are the sectors that are actually much harder to decarbonize? Where are the emissions coming from that we haven't quite got the answers to about how to get those emissions down?
So I don't think there's a sector. I think some companies might try to tell you it's just too hard.
Yes,
we can't do it.
Yeah. Not ask Gov, look elsewhere.
Exactly. And I don't think that's true. I think there are certainly sectors where it will take up much longer to decarbonize. So, for example, commercial airliners, the technology to power an airline with a battery, for example, that's simply not there, and it won't be there for many years to come. But I think what those industries can do is demonstrate an ambition. So you had, for example, recently Maersk, the world's largest shipping company, has announced a target that they are aiming to reach net zero emissions by 2050 and a 60% reduction in 2030 already from a 2008 baseline.
And so already 10 years on from that, and I imagine that being the largest shipping company, I mean, you see their shipping containers wherever you go along the coast. That's already an enormous commitment to be made.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're well aware that the technology to do this doesn't currently exist. We currently don't have the technology to power a cargo ship across the ocean. That doesn't exist yet. But by making the statement, they're sending a very strong signal to the market, again, that the demand is there. If you can make this product for us, there's demand. You have a customer.
And I imagine that to take this back to perhaps our position as Legal & General Investment Manager and your position in the corporate governance team, a statement like that, which is, you know, as long as it's backed up by a real commitment to perhaps the R&D, to perhaps a more noticeable and public actions, that really kind of assuages your concerns about such a company in their role as an emitter, would you say?
This notion of ambition is very interesting. It's a bit like thinking someone wants to become a runner and they say, yeah, but you know, I just can't run a marathon. I'm like, yeah, okay, not all of us have to run a marathon. You can train for 5K. And it's, I think, that conversation that we're starting to have with the companies, even in certain hard nuts to crack, like transport, shipping, things like that. I mean, okay, maybe it's very, very hard for big companies to do everything at once, like reduce all their emissions across, you know, big ocean liners moving across across, but to take the example of ships, not all ships go from one continent to the other, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have batteries for that. You may very well have batteries to ferry people from Dover to Calais. Mm-hmm. And you have Rolls-Royce working on engines, on battery-powered ships. So there's all that question of scale. Same with planes. You don't have, we probably won't fly over the Pacific in a plane, mm-hmm. but we might well be able to do, I don't know, London to Bristol.
Domestic flights, those sort of things.
So. I mean, EasyJet's looking into this, and they said if for some of the battery technologies that they're funding, that might cover around 30% of their European flights, it works.
So there are marginal gains to be had here, and that's really kind of what you guys seem to be looking for in your conversation with companies. Of, you don't have to have the whole answer, but at least show us that you are looking for an answer and what can be applied in the medium term in order to meet these emissions targets.
Certainly. It's, I think, the key thing that we're looking for companies is a recognition that the challenge facing the world economy in terms of trying to decarbonize in line with the 1.5 or below 2-degree target is absolutely huge. And there's no way we can solve this without all hands on deck, if you will. And what we really want to see from companies is a recognition that as a key player in the economy, they have a responsibility to do what is feasible for them to do, essentially, to help us all reach this collective target.
Yeah. So I feel like we've just talked a lot about transport. Are there any other sectors that you'd highlight as being particularly difficult or, you know, requiring very specific challenges in the to meet climate targets, which are perhaps might not be so applicable to elsewhere?
I think the food retail industry is very interesting. I think previously, food retailers might look at their emissions or look at their environmental impact in the sense that they're looking at the emissions coming from their stores or maybe from their trucks. But actually, what we're seeing now is a much broader recognition on the impact of their supply chains. So, for example, you have a company like Danone that's committed to be carbon neutral by 2050. Across its entire supply chain.
That's the yogurt maker, right?
Exactly.
I'm thinking of the same one.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's important because it means that the company is accounting also for the emissions from the farms where they source their ingredients from.
Okay.
And that's really crucial because something like a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture, forestry, and land use. So that's exactly the kind of broader thinking that we'd like to see from companies on these issues. So considering not just the impact of your immediate operations, but also what impact your business in terms of customers using your products and the input to your business, so your supply chain, what the impact of that entire chain is, essentially, and what your role is to play there in terms of decarbonization.
That's absolutely crucial, agriculture. And I think you also have other sort of either industrial processes or things like heat. It's very hard. Mm-hmm. We heat up our buildings in a particular way, and it's hard. They're a major contributor, and it's hard to do things about them, but it's not impossible. Partly it's an issue of building standards. So again, we're coming back to what the role of the state. You can set different building standards, and that all of a sudden, you know, raises the bar, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, in theory, hypothetically, Michael Liebrich talks about this. There's no reason why a new house couldn't produce more energy than it consumes.
Wow.
So, you know, you could be paid money rather than paying money to utilities.
Selling LNG back to the grid, which I think in Germany was a major thing that people were really kind of turning a profit on their home power generation abilities, whether it be wind turbines, solar panels.
Yeah, that's partly, like you're saying, electricity is slightly easier. But we can do progress even on the way we heat up our homes. And like, it's an interesting example. Like, there's a solar community in the U.S. which gets its winter heating from energy collected during the summer, actually.
Wow.
And this is, so it's all pretty much all driven by solar panels, more or less, to heat up. But this isn't too far from when they had the Winter Olympics in 1988 in Calgary. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it can be done, though it's probably harder. And it's harder particularly when you have old buildings. And I think the UK isn't leading on this, unfortunately.
There are a lot of stone buildings which I imagine that get very, very difficult and require a lot more power to heat than perhaps newly furbished houses.
But even so, I mean, you have some solutions. So think of it that normally we get our power in one place and our heating is separate. But actually, for most cases, you generate heat while you're producing electricity. So you can use that heat for what's so-called cogeneration or combined heat and power and use them in the same place. Or you can get even more creative, like you have nuclear reactors, small modular nuclear reactors, which as they release heat when they produce electricity, you can use that heat to create hydrogen, the electrolysis, and then you use that hydrogen for sort of high-energy pulses, which you use in industry. So there are ways to be creative around this. I think that's the key bit.
That's really fascinating to understand more about the technological developments that can be used in more innovative ways to meet these challenging needs. To wrap this up, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the role of us as investors and your role in the corporate governance team. How can we as investors or our customers and you at a policy level drive the change that is required to meet these emissions targets?
A key focus of ours is that we aim to be an engaged owner, an active owner in the companies that we invest in. And our climate impact pledge engagement is the sort of flagship initiative in this area. So under the pledge, we've committed to engage with 84 of the world's largest companies by market cap in 6 sectors that are absolutely crucial to the low carbon transition. And as part of this this commitment, we assess companies on how they are strategically approaching climate change. And where we identify gaps, we hold in-depth conversations with the companies to try and encourage them to move sort of further and faster. And likewise, doing this work, we see a lot of great leadership as well. Yeah. And we're equally committed to highlighting and naming and faming the companies that are really stepping up and showing leadership on this issue.
So your position, being able to meet with company management, company boards all the time, allows you to not only say, you know, you're failing, you're not green enough, you need to do more. You can also say, well, look, these companies have really done it so well. This is best practice, and we think this could work for you. And you can really be a helping hand. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, I think a lot of times our role is to be a sort of sounding board to companies, if you will, and help demonstrate as an investor, this is what we see happening in your sector, and this is what we consider to be best practice. And if it's not currently on your horizon or your agenda, maybe it should be.
Yeah.
I think that's a powerful tool because you can think, you know, giving the slightly pessimistic note about people not doing enough, it's one thing to always say you need to do more. But the way you frame it, you're not supposed to be telling a utility company, why aren't you as good as some sort of local community bank or something like that? No, but you can tell a utility company, why aren't you doing what other utilities are doing? Look there. That is best practice.
Okay.
And that's a different kind of lever and a different type of pressure.
Yeah.
Now, on top of that, I think that the climate pledge is one of the key things we do as within the team. And that will be something we do for all our clients because we think it's in their interest and a sort of societal interest that these companies work towards sustainability and think of climate change as a priority. But equally, we've been working for sort of clients who might feel we need to get there quicker, so to speak. So we'll be doing that for all our customers, but we're also working on low carbon funds and investments for people who think, look, I'm concerned about how my investments are doing or the impact of my particular investments. So maybe I want to reduce, let's say, the carbon I own or finance in the world. And then you help them develop your own funds, low carbon funds, and you can take a stance through that as well.
So you can be a good environmental citizen, not just through, you know, very personal, I recycle, for instance, you know, I only buy biodegradable packaged products, but at the same time, you know, using your pension, you can make an active decision saying, I'm going to allocate more money to these funds or companies which have really embraced, you know, doing more to meet these targets.
This is a bit like a sleeping dragon. Probably the world's largest investors aren't the people you think of, you know, the Jeff Bezos of the world. They're probably regular savers who collectively have these huge pension pots, which have been underutilized in this particular sense. There's a lot of impact that can be had. And I think, at least in the UK, you have some government pressure for these pensions to invest their money in, let's say, helping infrastructure, helping build the economy, you know, huge pots which can affect real change, actually, both away from the sort of negative, shall we say, and more importantly, into the solutions.
And leveraging the power of pensions, I think, will be crucial because in order to get or to keep the world on a below 2-degree trajectory, it's been estimated that we're going to need about $1-3 trillion of investments in renewable energy and energy efficiency measures per year. And that's just simply not going to be possible without private pensions and your everyday investor on the street, your saver on the street.
Wow. So thank you so much to both of you. It's a very much a glass half empty view on one front with we need to do a lot more to meet these emissions targets, but a glass half full because of the amount of impact that we can have through corporate governance, through good management, through government policies, and through investors' choices. Make companies and the world a better place. Thank you so much, Yanko and Yasmin.
Thank you
very much.
And thank you for listening. Thank you to our wonderful production team and our amazing producer, Holly McNulty. Listen again next week to hear more from Elsham Talks. Thank you very much. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.